and welcome to Galactic Chat. I'm David McDonald, and I'm coming to you from Continuum 9 Contraindicators. If you're not here, you are missing out. We're having a great time. And just make sure you remember that if you missed out this year, you have to come next year because it will be the NatCon. I'm very fortunate to have our guest of honour with me, N.K. Jemison. I'm sure that most of you would have heard of her. Her work has garnered significant critical and award nomination fame. Her debut novel, The 100,000 Kingdoms, won a Locus Award in 2011, and The Killing Moon was recently nominated for a Nebula and for a Locus Award. So really excited to have Nora here. So Nora, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. So are you having a good time in Australia so far?
I am indeed. I have been to a hot spring out in the bush. I am told it is the bush on the peninsula. I have been to some wineries. I have visited the Immigration Museum and the Melbourne Museum and wandered about. I have ridden on the tram repeatedly and tried to get lost and failed miserably. So it's been a lot of fun.
So are there any things you've struggled to acclimatise to? I know people have introduced you to Vegemite. Have you managed to try that yet?
I have been given a jar of Vegemite and warned to eat it spread only very thinly over whatever I put it on. I have not actually eaten it yet because I don't want to open it before I start traveling. I'll wait until I get back to the States to eat it. And I have been informed that I must try a Tim Tam Slam.
Definitely have to try
a Tim Tam. I have been given a box of Tim Tams. I've eaten them all. And I am carrying a big value pack of Tim Tams back now for folks back at home.
Well, they're some of the key things you've got to experience in Australia, but I hope no one's been scaring you too much with stories about all our killer animals.
I got that before I came here. When I mentioned on Twitter that I was coming to Australia, a bunch of Australians apparently make a habit of jumping on Americans who are coming here and trying to fool them with the whole story about drop bears. So I was told to watch out for drop bears in, like, complete seriousness. And I'm like, that doesn't sound right. But apparently a lot of Americans fall for it and believe that drop bears are real.
Well, koalas actually, they seem cute and cuddly, but they're actually not that nice either.
That I can believe. But the idea that they lurk in the trees waiting for unsuspecting people to walk by so that they can eat their heads, yeah, no.
Yeah. Makes so a good short story, I'm sure.
I guess it might.
So obviously, we've really enjoyed having you as guest of honour. Your work's been really well received on the international stage, and obviously even filtered down here to Australia in upside down country. So one of the things I was interested to ask you is, what were some of your influences that informed your writing? Did you have any writing heroes as you grew up that you wanted to write
too like? Many to narrow down, honestly. In terms of influences, my influences ranged from things as disparate as bebop jazz music to anime and manga to video games to mythology. But in terms of writers, that ranged pretty widely too. Tanith Lee, Louise Cooper, Storm Constantine, Octavia Butler, Tolkien, of course. I could go on that one for quite some time. There's a lot of them. Yeah.
So was there any point where you went from being a consumer to being a writer, or did you always write?
I've been writing since I was like 10, so not really. I wasn't seriously writing for most of like my childhood because I was a child. Yeah. But yes, I have been writing since I went to see a movie and came away from it annoyed and feeling like I could do a better job than that, and I really couldn't, but I thought I could, so I started writing. And really, it was not until I turned, like, maybe 30 that I sort of looked at my life. I had my early midlife crisis at the age of 30 and was like, okay, I've been doing this writing all my life. I've enjoyed it. I've written novels, tons of novels at that point. Most of them were terrible. Am I serious about this, or is this going to continue just being something I dabble in on the side forever? And I decided to try and get serious at that point and went to some workshops. Joined a writing workshop, a writing group, and then started from there on trying to do submissions of short stories and that kind of thing. And then it kind of grew from there.
So was there a moment where you went, yes, I'm actually making a real go of this? Was there a sale or an award or some recognition that made you think that...
It wasn't the award or the recognition, it was the starting that I think for me was the demarcation line. Because if you wait for the awards, you'll get discouraged, you'll drop out. For me, when I joined my writing group was the Brawlers in Boston, is what they were called. Used to be called just the Boston Area Science Fiction Writers, but we decided we needed better marketing. So the Brawlers, one of the things that they did was we celebrated rejections, because it's not getting acceptances, it's not getting published that's what makes you a professional writer, it's going through the process of trying to be professionally published. So, you know, every 50 rejections we would do, I'm sorry, I just hate lunch, every 50 rejections we would do a party somewhere. You know, if it was just 50 rejections, it was just, you know, we met for a beer at the local bar. If it was 100 rejections, we would all go out for margaritas. You know, it just got progressively better. In theory, if we had gotten up to 250 rejections, I think we were talking about doing a strip club visit, but we never got that far. None of us did. So, yeah.
Well, that's definitely a much better way of celebrating rejections than, you know, crying like some of us might do.
We had all kinds of rituals. I have saved all of my paper rejection letters, and the switch over to electronic letters has actually been a bit of a problem for me, but I am determined to, when I buy a house, wallpaper my bathroom with my rejection letters. So I don't have enough, and unfortunately now all these publishers are doing electronic rejections. I suppose I could print them out, but that's not as interesting.
So we've talked about the rejection side of it, but so your books have been very successful in terms of award nominations. I think looking at one of them, there was about 10 nominations for various different awards.
Yeah, the 100,000 Kingdoms got nominated for everything I could possibly think of. It didn't win a lot of it, but it did get nominated.
So did you set yourself any goals in terms of things that you'd like to achieve in terms of awards, or is it just something that has just happened organically?
In terms of awards, being nominated for things like the Hugo and the Nebula and the World Fantasy has been incredibly heartening in and of itself. I would like to win, but at the same time, you know, when the stock saying is it's an honor just to be nominated, it really is. You know, when you go to these gala awards events and you see who you are sharing that shortlist with, and you realize that a lot of people know your name who would not otherwise because you're on that list. I have made sales that would never have happened if I didn't have Hugo nominee or Nebula nominee on my book. You know, libraries in the United States especially, I don't know about everywhere else. And I think a lot of the international recognition that I've gotten has been because of those nominations. And winning, sure, would be nice. But it's clear that the nomination itself is what's gotten me this far. The nominations themselves have been what would have gotten me this far. So beyond that, I've met that goal. I'm very happy with the way that the books have been received.
And amongst that list of honours, you've also made the James Tiptree Junior Award honours list as well, which I think is probably a bit of a different award than something like the Hugo, where it's it celebrates books that explore gender roles. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously one of the things you're very well known for is the skill with which you explore some of the, I guess, the voices and representations that perhaps haven't made it into mainstream sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
So is that something that you deliberately set out to do, or
what? Get on the Tiptree list? No.
No. To explore some of those representations that haven't made it into the traditional sci-fi.
I don't set out to do anything in particular when I'm writing, except try and tell a good story. And I think the only thing that maybe is maybe different about what I do is that my sense of what a good story is veers away from what has been done to death, in my opinion, too many more times. You know, I have the same love of stuff blowing up and you know, adventures and boon companions and things like that as everybody else. It's just that I don't think the only people who should be having those adventures are, you know, the standard, the stock white farm boy who discovers that he is secretly a prince or something like that. I get a bit bored with that. So I write about people that I find a little off that beaten trail, whatever they happen to be, male, female, but they tend to be not white farm boys. So, yeah.
So are there any authors or books you think that in the past have perhaps done that better than others? And are there any currently doing it that you admire for doing that?
There's a lot of writers that are doing a good job of it currently. And I feel especially kind of lucky to be alive now when I am, because there's a lot more stuff available than there used to be. When I was younger in science fiction, because I read a lot of science fiction, in science fiction there were really, for a very long time, there were four writers of color, period. Hopkinson, Butler, Delaney, and Barnes. And the interesting thing was when Tobias Bakel, who was also a writer of color, Tobias Bakel started talking about race a few years ago in science fiction and fantasy. He has this really kind of famous and hilarious post where he's taking the science fiction genre to task for the fact that whenever you asked about representation of people of color in those days, science fiction readers and fan and writers would quickly sort of say Hopkinson, Butler, Delaney, and Barnes, as if he said the plus four defense against accusations of racism. Since then, there are a lot more. There have always been a lot of us, and in some cases, it's been a more hidden thing. But that said, there's a lot more writers of color. There's a lot more women writing who are not hidden behind initials. There's a lot more writers of different underrepresented groups that are writing. And there's a lot more writers who are of the more typical standard represented groups who are actually starting trying to write characters who are different. Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn series has a female protagonist, which was actually relatively not done around the time that those books first became published. Lots done in Australian epic fantasy, by the way, and I've been talking with Trudy Canavan about that a lot. There's some really noticeable and distinctive differences between Australian and American epic fantasy. It's a lot more egalitarian here. In the U.S., female protagonists and female writers are rare, and when they exist, they don't do that well compared to the male writers. I don't get that. We were going to talk more about that, but then I came to do my sign. I'm wandering now. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, that's fine. Something I was going to ask is, it could be easy for Australians to pat ourselves on the back, because if you look at our awards list, we do have a lot of female writers who are winning awards, and as you said, our epic fantasy has a lot of female protagonists, and I think it's obviously something that, you know, is a great thing, but coming from another country to Australia, is that reflected in your perception, or do you think that's perhaps something where we're...
I have not read a lot of Australian fiction, I have to admit. I have noticed the disparity between the number of writers of epic fantasy, female writers of epic fantasy, who seem to be doing okay here versus the ones in the States. Beyond that, I haven't seen a whole lot. But like I said, I'm not that well immersed in Australian epic fantasy or speculative fiction in general.
Now, I think you have touched on this in some of the talks you've given this weekend, and something I personally find very interesting as a writer. I think sometimes writers can be a little bit scared to write outside their own demographic or their own experience. Do you have any advice on whether people should do that or whether they shouldn't, or how they should go about it? What are some of the...
Well, advice, not specifically. I mean, you know, it's a choice that every writer has to make for him or herself. How comfortable they feel going outside their comfort zone. I tend to be of the opinion, I can only speak for myself, I tend to be of the opinion that every writer has to do that. Especially if you're a speculative fiction writer. I mean, if you're going to be writing about mythological creatures or aliens or something like that, and you can't handle writing about people of another race who exist on your own planet, you've got a failure of the imagination somewhere in there. But that's me, and that's my feeling about it. And there are a lot of people who feel substantial fear over making that attempt because they think they're going to get something wrong. But the thing is, yeah, you are going to get something wrong. Everyone does. That should not be a reason to stop you. I mean, if you're going to write about people, you're going to get something wrong. So be prepared to take whatever lumps that you're going to get for that. I mean, science fiction writers in particular are happy to try and write about theoretical physics, and they may get something wrong, and they may be excoriated by the science fiction community. And they don't seem to have the kind of angst over that they do over writing about people and being excoriated by that community. I mean, is very similar. You know, it's almost like for whatever reason people have invested this greater sense of fear in getting the people wrong than in getting the science wrong. And I understand that because people have feelings. People are hurt by this kind of getting it wrong. But on the other hand, if you're willing to take your lumps for that, but you're not willing to take your lumps for the other thing, that fear in and of itself is pathological. That fear in and of itself, people are afraid of being called racist, but they're being racist by avoiding the thing that might get them called racist. I mean, I just feel like it's a sign of good writing. I feel like if you're going to be a good writer, you take chances, especially if you're a speculative fiction writer. If you want to be a literary writer and just write about the stuff that everybody knows and everybody can understand, then fine, do that. That may be safer in some ways. And now I'm going to bring the wrath of the literary community down on me. But that said, if you're going to write about speculative stuff, you need to be able to handle people. And the only way to do that is by trying. And maybe getting it wrong, but, you know, learn, move on, apologize if you need to, get better.
Have you ever had that experience where you felt that you've written something and then looking back that you might have gotten it wrong?
Yeah. I've talked about this on my blog a few times. A typical example with my book, The Broken Kingdoms, which was the second book in the Inheritance trilogy. The protagonist was a blind woman. Although she had the magical ability to see magic. She couldn't see, like, the table, but if there was a magic object on the table, she could see the magic object. And I did not realize as I was working on this, and I researched it as meticulously as I could. I read memoirs by blind people. I read, in particular, a really interesting memoir by a blind man who had been sighted most of his life, lost his sight for about 10 years because of a tumor thing, got the tumor removed, got his sight back. And that was a really interesting memoir, kind of because it sort of touched on that partial sightedness that I was actually trying to explore. What I did not do was read a whole bunch of science fiction and fantasy or literature that featured blind characters, mostly because there wasn't a whole lot of it out there to begin with. But I had not, because it was not my particular focus, I had not noticed that there were certain tropes that had become cliché, like the blind person who has a magical ability. The magical disabled person is a trope. If you go to TV Tropes, you'll see it there. In particular, the magical blind person. I did not realize that I had done that. And I had. I, by the numbers, hit that trope, hit that cliché. And, you know, I got some pushback from readers. I got some visually impaired readers and just other readers who were more aware of the issue said, hey, look, you did this. That's kind of messed up. And I was like, holy crap, I did do that. And, whoa, sorry about that. By the way, I'm now trying to research this better. And the next time that I write about disabled people, I'm going to try not to hit that particular mistake. I might make other mistakes, but I'm not going to make that mistake. And I'm not going to stop writing about disabled people. I'm not disabled myself, fortunately, and in some ways for now, because that is not necessarily a permanent state. But, you know, that doesn't mean that I can't write about this group. It means I need to do a better job of it. And that is what the criticism means, is become a better writer. And I'm always trying to do that.
So, I mean, I don't want you to give away any secrets, but what does the future hold for your writing? Do you have any things that you would like to write about that you haven't done so yet that are on the horizon?
Constantly. I am working right now on what I've been calling the Untitled Magic Seismology Project, which is an upcoming trilogy. It's already sold to Orbit, but I've just got to finish it. In which, I haven't developed the elevator pitch yet. Basically, it's a post-apocalyptic fantasy set in a world where volcanic winter happens frequently. Essentially, extinction-level events frequently reboot society. And people in this world have developed the magical ability to manipulate stone and earthquakes and volcanoes and so on. Seismology. And so the story follows a woman who has this ability, whose child has been killed, and she's trying to find the child's killer. So we'll see what happens.
Sounds like a pretty good pitch to me. So.
Working on it, and yeah. I've left out a whole lot, but, you know, anyway. It's probably my first contiguous epic fantasy series. Most of what I've been writing so far are three self-contained books set in the same universe, or two self-contained books set in the same universe. I am experimenting at last with writing a tripartite story across three books. I think three books is as far as I'll be able to sustain it. I've never understood how writers could do, like, 10-book series, but, you know, that's just me. But it's my first time trying to write one of those, so we'll see how that goes.
Now, we're talking earlier, and you're saying that you've very much been in novel mode. Are you looking at doing short stories perhaps set in the same worlds, or is that something that's still on the back burner while you continue on with the novel?
I haven't had a lot of time for short story writing, but I do enjoy writing short stories. Mm-hmm. And often I will write a short story set in the world, in the novel world that I'm trying to figure out, as a kind of proof of concept thing. I will try it as a short story first. If it doesn't work as a short story, then that gives me an idea of what I need to tweak or fix in order to make it work as a novel. And I've done that for the Magic Seismology project already. But that said, those stories aren't always publishable because they are done as part of an existing larger universe. They don't stand alone very well. So, I mean, we'll see how that goes. But normally I don't write short stories based on my novels. Usually the short stories are something completely different.
Are there any of the short story markets that you think are doing particularly innovative things?
I haven't tried to publish short stories for quite some time, but I have been happy with Clark's World. I do think that they're doing a nice sort of fusion. Well, not fusion. They're not as interested in the genre of what you're doing as they are in good writing, and that really kind of shows through in what they've been doing. They're more willing to take a literary approach to speculative material than they are interested in speculative material, you know, that's written in a plain fashion. I think Lightspeed is doing some interesting stuff too. Lightspeed is the fusion of what used to be Lightspeed and Fantasy Magazine. Fantasy Magazine was doing some awesome stuff before it got fused into Lightspeed, and it's continuing to do awesome stuff. That's all I really know about right now, sadly. Yeah.
Obviously, it's been talked about a fair bit, but the recent SFWA Borsen issue has shown us that a lot of the issues that we'd like to say, you know, we've moved past are still around. Do you see steady progress in the spec fic field? Do you think that we're still living 20 years ago? What are the signs good or bad for what's happening in the community?
Well, the signs are good. They're just slow and a bit stagnaty, if that's a word. I declare it a word. I'm a writer. I can do that. But speculative fiction styles itself as this progressive thing. It's not. Ow, I spit my tongue. Sorry. It really isn't, and it has not been for quite some time. It's been resting on its laurels and calling itself progressive, but it has not done very much to kind of earn that label. You know, and the fact that these kinds of kerfuffles keep happening is the sign of that. But at the same time, the fact that these kinds of kerfuffles have been happening more and more in recent years is a sign of change. It used to be, as I said in my guest of honor speech yesterday, used to be that these kinds of sexist statements would just be tossed off and people wouldn't even care. People wouldn't say any... Scratch that. People cared. They just wouldn't say anything for fear of offending the big-name writers who said these kinds of things. Or in some cases, the big-name writers who did these kinds of things. If you talk to older writers, I'm still relatively new in the field, but when I've been talking to older writers who've been around for a lot longer, they've told me horror stories about, you know, famous science fiction and fantasy writers running around pinching women's butts at science fiction cons, or doing worse things. I mean, getting away with it because people just didn't have either the guts or in some cases the support to say something about it or to protest it. And they didn't think that the science fiction field would be willing to acknowledge that change was necessary back then. It's not that willing to acknowledge that change is necessary now, but it is more willing. So, I mean, there is some progress, at least in that respect. A true sign of progress would be this stuff not happening anymore, though. A true sign of us living in the future or really acknowledging the value of the mythic stuff that we've been dabbling in would be these kinds of fails not happening. We've got a ways to go before that happens. But, you know, we're starting in that direction.
Speaking of your guest of honour speech, I believe that's already up on your blog, so we'll put a link to that in, okay. in the show notes.
Okay.
So those of you who are listening who are intrigued by that, please check that out because...
Just a quick thing. I'm told that there was a recording of it, a visual recording of it, and I ad-libbed a lot, and there were also some question and answer stuff that happened afterward that I did not put into the blog. I am told that I will be given a link to that. I will put that on my blog as well. So, just FYI.
Well, it's worth following Nora's blog anyway until that link comes up, because you do write some fascinating stuff on there.
Thank you.
How hard do you find it to write and to do conventions and to do social media and to do the blog? Is there a struggle with that?
I blog a lot more when I'm not in deadline hell. I am in deadline hell right now, which is why my blog has been sparsely updated in the last 2 or 3 months. As someone who also has a full-time job on top of that, it is hard. It's very hard. And I sustain it as best I can by kind of narrowing down the amounts of time I'm going to spend on this or that. Basically, like, for example, I used to blog more frequently than I do now. I blog maybe once every 2 weeks or so. I used to try and do blogging once a week, but my writing was beginning to suffer as a result of that, so I don't do that. But I am very active on Twitter, because Twitter is easy. I can do Twitter while I'm... Don't tell my boss. I can do Twitter while I'm at work, in between whatever other tasks I'm doing. It takes, 30 seconds to spill off some 144-character blurb about whatever, and then go back to doing productive stuff. So Twitter has become kind of my main source of social media lately. Facebook, I just feeds off of Twitter for the most part. I haven't really adopted any of the newer things like Tumblr or whatever because I don't understand them. And also I feel like I'm doing enough. I talk about the things that interest me, so it's not that I'm like forcing myself to talk about things that, or taking time away from my writing to talk about things that I just to promote myself. I don't see any value in that. I feel like it's better to talk about things that interest me, hope that other people are interested, and see if that sells my writing more than me just simply talking about my writing all the time. But that's just, how to market yourself as a writer these days. So it's tough, but on the other hand, I'm doing a lot of things that I find fun.
Do you have your own home convention, one that you consider your convention that you...
Not really. I go to... there's nothing local that I really make a lot of time for. There's a number of conventions in the New York area. There's a... LunaCon, there's also the New York Comic Con, things like that, but I don't always go to those, mostly because New York Comic Con is stupidly expensive, and also LunaCon is a little out of the way. I live in the city, it's up in, somewhere up north. If I had to choose a convention that I liked more than any other, it would probably be WisCon, which I'm going to be going to as a guest of honor next year, but that's in Wisconsin, that's nowhere near me. It's just closer to my heart in terms of the subject matter that they're willing to tackle. It's a feminist science fiction convention, and feminist in the sense of, or at least it aspires to be feminist in the sense of intersectionality, third wave feminism, really inclusive in talking about race and gender and disability and poverty and oppression and a lot of those issues. So I've learned a lot from being at WisCon. I've had some frustrations from being at WisCon. But I like that generally I have become a better writer as a result of WisCon.
And you're saying that you're in a writer's group. Are you still in the Boston Brawler as well?
No, now I live in New York, so I'm in Altered Fluid, which is a writer's group there. We have a website, alteredfluid.com, I think. I've been on hiatus with them for the last few months because I've been in novel mode, and they mostly critique short stories. And like I said, I haven't been writing many short stories, but they're a great group, and they contain a number of up-and-coming writers who are pretty big names. Saladin Ahmed, who was also publishing, was in Altered Fluid until he moved to Detroit. But we never let go of people, so he's still in Altered Fluidian. And there's a number of other writers who are doing some really amazing stuff there. David Rivera, Kate Tempest Bradford, Elijah Don Johnson is a fantasy writer who's doing some really innovative and interesting stuff. Her book, The Summer Prince, just came out. So we're a good group. We're pretty dynamic. And I love still being part of a group, even though I have been on hiatus.
Well, there's that community aspect, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that you're someone who needs to be around other writers, or you prefer your own space? Or
I do, which is probably the main reason why I still live in New York, even though it's stupidly expensive and I might not have to work quite so hard if I didn't live there. But New York in and of itself has this gigantic community of writers, which has both practical and artistic value. Artistically speaking, if I want to go and hear a reading of science fiction writers or speculative fiction writers and hear some kind of new, hot, cool stuff, I can do that fairly frequently in New York because there's the KGB readings, there's the NERSF, New York Review of Science Fiction readings, there's my own writing group which meets once a week. Excuse me, there's the Hour of the Wolf radio show on public access television, radio. There's a number of resources there that just happen to be conglomerated in that city. And on a more practical note, there are enough writers, not just spec fic writers, but just writers in general, there are enough writers in New York City that if I were able to quit my full-time job and I needed something like health insurance, the Authors Guild there is big enough to actually provide health insurance for writers at substantial cost, but, I mean, affordable. Whereas if I lived in another part of the States, it would cost 3 times as much. So, and health insurance for those of us who live in countries that don't have universal health care is a big and important issue. So, yes.
Yes, I think sometimes we forget in Australia, that's one of the areas where we are quite lucky.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, I'm going to put you on the spot here. If we'll just pick an arbitrary number of 5. If there were 5 novels that you would recommend people go out and read from, say, the past 50 or 60 years that don't perhaps get the publicity they should?
Oh, that's a really hard question.
You don't have to do 5. You can pick whatever number you like.
No. The problem is narrowing down to 5. That's a really hard question. I can't narrow down books specifically, maybe authors. But is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
I always recommend Octavia Butler. Pretty much anything she writes is really just awesome. Hard, painful, difficult to read, but awesome. I am a huge fan of Storm Constantine, although her earlier stuff was written when she was a teenager, and in some cases that kind of shows. But as she's gotten older and stronger as a writer, that also shows. So I would recommend most of what she writes. Tanith Lee has been awesome forever. I'm still very much enamored, though, of her Flat Earth novels. I have not kept up with her recent writing, I'm sad to say. I just don't have a lot of time for reading anymore. I think that may be... I think 3 may be as far as we can go.
No, that's fine.
It's just hard to narrow down. I love so many people.
As I said, I was putting you on the spot a little bit there. And I'm going to do that one more time. Up-and-coming writers that you think are worth keeping an eye on?
This is hard! I know too many up-and-coming writers. I can't narrow down. I mentioned Alia Dawn Johnson. I love her stuff. She has a dangerous tendency, she's going to laugh when she hears this, she has a dangerous tendency to write cliffhangers. I'm still mad at her about one cliffhanger in particular that I've been giving her crap about for years. But I can't wait to read her Summer Prince, I just haven't had time. I am a huge fan of Mira Grant / Shauna McGuire. I have her latest book, Parasite, for reading on the way back to the States, so I'm really looking forward to that. It's got brain parasites in it, and if there's turbulence and there's nausea, that might be a bad thing. But it's a good book so far. I'm a huge raging fan of Kate Griffin / Catherine Webb, I think is her real name. She started in the children's market and is now doing epic fantasy. Urban fantasy. And I love her books set in the Matthew Swift universe. I've been jokingly saying that her stuff is kind of like the Dresden Files if it was written by China Mieville or Ursula Le Guin or something like that. It's beautifully written, completely unique to her own style. It's not like them. I'm doing her a horrible disservice by comparing her to other writers, but that's an elevator pitch. Once again, I'm having trouble narrowing.
No, that's a great start for people, I think. Okay. Well, look, I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you've been very busy this weekend being the guest of honour, so I just want to thank you for coming on board to Galactic Chat. Okay. I hope you have a lovely rest of your time in Australia.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks very much.